Paul Perry, the renowned filmmaker and a best-selling author. It is such an honor to have you.
No, it's great to be here.
Can you tell us a bit about your background and how you started in this film industry?
I got bored with writing, frankly. I mean, I was spending, I've written a lot of books. I've written over 20 books. And I just found myself isolated as a writer. Everyone says they want to be a writer, but they really don't. They don't know what it's like. And so I decided I was going to, I've always been visual. I was a photo editor at a newspaper here. And so I developed my visual aspects. And I decided, well, I want to make some documentaries out of my own books. And that's when I went and did Jesus in Egypt. That was about 4 weeks after 9/11. And I went over there and wrote a book and then came back and was offered a chance to go back and make a documentary. And so I went back and did that. And that was it. I really got drawn to that type of life, where you don't know what's going to happen next. You know you're going to interview somebody, but you don't necessarily know what they're going to say. And as a result, you just it's just a different kind of life.
And the topics that you explore are very unique. History, spirituality, humankind. What inspired you to explore this topic, these topics?
I think if you look at the media, like I don't want to rip on Netflix, but if you look at something like Netflix or most of the streaming media, there's a lot of vacuums, a lot of things they don't cover. And I think one of the things is spirituality. Yet, in fact, spirituality is very important to virtually everybody, even whether they know it or not. So that's why I got hooked on that. And then I'm also just intrigued by it in my own life. It's like a Coptic priest said to me. He said, spirituality is like water. It's hard to define, but you know that you need it. And I found that that was really very true in my life. Not really that interested in structured religion, but I'm interested in the basis of religion, which is this undefinable thing called spirituality. And that's what draws me to it. And it's also, so it's that, and it's this big vacuum of it in the media. There's just not enough about spirituality in the media.
How do you cultivate your spirituality?
By studying other people's spirituality. I think that's one reason. I mean, oftentimes journalists have trouble answering that because journalists, and I think much of the training involves not being committed to one point of view or another. But and that's what I've kind of done in my life is not be committed to one point of view or another, but try to gather as many points of view as I can. And so that's how I've manifested it in my life.
Now, I'd like to touch on this creative process. How do you choose the subjects for your films, and what criteria do you use?
I choose my subjects pretty much the way any freelance writer would. I pick things that are interesting that can hold my attention for a long period of time. For instance, we decided to do a documentary about Christopher Columbus because there was so much legend in Europe that Columbus wasn't Italian and that he was actually Portuguese and related to the royal families. I didn't really believe that necessarily. It sounded like fake news to me, but there was something about the story that drew me in. And what we did was we relied on DNA taken from Columbus by the head of the CSI department at Granada University. And he found that Columbus was related to the Portuguese royal family. And that changed the whole story about Columbus. Because he then took that information and spread it through the academic community in the world. And they all decided that based on his DNA, he was not born in Italy. And they started to find different things about him, that he didn't speak Italian, that he spoke a mix of Castilian and Southern Spain and Portuguese. So that explains why he was always people always said that he spoke with a very strange accent, and that's because his mother was Jewish, born in Cuba, Portugal, and she had a child with the Duke of Beja, and that child was Christopher Columbus. And then we just started to follow this amazing chain of evidence that when he went to, when he discovered, he never did make it to America, but when he discovered the islands off the coast of America, all the places that he named are named for towns around his town of Cuba, where he was born. So he named Cuba, and then he named all these other San Salvador and places like that. So that worked in the same way DNA would, you know, that this was like his DNA matched the DNA of the royal family of Portugal, and he had a kind of a geographic DNA too, you know. So it's actually been fascinating, and it's fun to follow these weird little chains of information and see that they really blow up into something bigger.
You've been working on many projects. What was your favorite so far?
Wow. Probably Jesus in Egypt. That was the most fun. It's the unknown Jesus. You know, in the Bible, there's five verses that say he spent time in Egypt. He went in as a child, probably about 2 years old, and he left Egypt at about 6 years old. That's what you piece together from the Bible. But there's a whole bunch of gospels that were written about Jesus that aren't included in the Bible. And those are considered apocryphal, or they're considered lost books of the Bible. And if you go through those, you see all these stories that took place in Egypt that aren't accounted for in the Bible. And then when you go through the Quran, you find out that the Quran is full of stories about Jesus, Mary, and Joseph that aren't included in the Bible at all. And if you piece all those together and find places that fit in Egypt, you have a map of Jesus in Egypt. So it was great to follow the trail of the unknown Jesus. And that's what we did. We got a map from Pope Shenouda, who's the Pope, the Coptic Pope, Pope of the Coptic Church in Egypt. And we followed that map. And it was, culturally, it was wonderful, because Egyptians are terrific people. It was also right after 9/11. And it was interesting to see how the impression of Middle Easterners was in reality, as opposed to the way they were cast in news. You know, and I think news always covers action, and they cover the violence and things like that. But most of the world isn't violent. You know, most of the world has just people who just want to live and have a good time. And that's what we found, a very open society. So those are a couple of reasons.
What kind of impact did it have on you and also others?
Well, what it has a huge impact on Egypt. And you find that a lot of these spiritual subjects, like when you talk about relics and things like that, have a huge impact on people in Europe and in the Middle East. So with Jesus is a factor in both religions, you know, Islam and Christianity. I don't want to overstate it, but they have a way of uniting over that Holy Family trail. You know, because it does have a lot to do with Muhammad, and then it has everything to do with Jesus. So these things have a way of uniting people, and that was one of the most interesting things to me about the Holy Family Trail was that they had actually taken the trouble to pull a Holy Family Trail together. You know, was also neat as well. So. And there's visions and miracles all along the trail. There were visions and miracles in the stories about Jesus, but there's visions and miracles now in Egypt. For example, we went to Assut, which is in the center of Egypt. And that's where Joseph was told by an angel that King Herod had died, you can return to Israel. And for hundreds of years now, there have been visions of light in the sky. And people come from all over North Africa. They come from all over Europe to see this. I've never seen an article about it at all in American media. And what happens is you're standing there, and out of the sky there's these flashing lights that just boom, just come down from the heavens. I have a photo of one. I'll be glad to give it to you to show. But it's very intense. There, it's a healing light, by the way. And there's a lot of people who say they've been healed by it. Finally, in the year 2000, a whole bunch of Coptic priests got together who were medically oriented as well as engineers. And they had this massive sighting of these lights, and people coming into the church saying, I've been healed of different things, cancer, all the way to cancer, to infertility, you know, it's the whole range. And so they decided to scientifically study it. And what they did was they wrote up a, what had happened. They made everyone follow this this pattern, writing about what had happened, where they were standing, what time, what did it heal, blah, blah, blah. And then they would only accept this questionnaire if the people also brought their medical records, proving that they had had a change in their health status. And they had hundreds of records. And then what these Coptic priests did was they put together a whole council of Muslim doctors and Christian doctors. And they had each doctor look at each file and decide whether it had been a miracle or not. And they found that a vast majority of these people had in fact been healed. And some of them were very extraordinary. One boy had a fracture in his arm, in the bone of his arm. And an x-ray showed that there was a gap, that it wasn't healing. And then after the light, after he had been engulfed by the light, about 2 or 3 days later, it had closed. And there's a whole bunch of cases like that, which I thought was a brilliant way to examine miracles. You know, so my goal is to go back and take some American doctors and do the same thing, you know, to show it to an American audience.
By showing it to an American audience, what do you hope to achieve?
Well, Americans, in my estimation, only have a tendency to believe in Western medicine. You know, they don't cotton to Qigong, for one thing. They kind of give, with the exception of Lancet and journals like that, they don't really accept European research. But they'll accept American research. And so that's why I would bring Americans over to do research that would be readily accepted by an American audience.
When creating these religious or spiritual documentaries, what were some of the challenges that you faced?
Very few challenges, actually. Yeah, I don't think there's that many. Many challenges. People are willing to talk about them. Once again, I think they're less willing in the United States, because there is in many ways an aversion to religion or spirituality in the U.S., although you see it springing up now in more and more ways. People know they're missing something, and they know it can be called spirituality.
How do you make sure that your work is engaging and meaningful to the audience?
You have to work at that. I mean, with anything, you have to work at that, you know, with any kind of media. So you have to put things in the right place. You have to hook. You have to hook people into appreciating what you appreciate. You know, you have to remember that people don't know as much about it as you do after you've researched it. So you have to make sure that you're speaking to an audience that isn't as educated in this particular area as you are. And that's it. I mean, it's really on the burden of the person who makes the film, you know, or writes the book.
Speaking of what you are interested in, you are very interested in near-death experiences.
I am, yeah.
And you've worked closely with Dr. Raymond Moody. Right. How did this happen? How did you guys meet?
It was in 1988, I believe. We worked together that long. But I was executive editor of a magazine called American Health Magazine, which was a major health, consumer health magazine in New York. And my book agent called me one day and said, let's go have lunch. I want to talk to you about Raymond Moody. And I didn't know who Raymond Moody was. I had no idea. And so Nat, my agent, said, I want you to write a book with Raymond. Raymond is supposed to finish this book called The Light Beyond, but he just can't pull the trigger. He needs some help. And I said, I don't know who Raymond is. And he says, well, you know what a near-death experience is, don't you? I don't. I have no idea. And he says, well, Raymond's a guy who named the near-death experience and defined it. Great. And so Nat said, well, look, for being the editor of a major health magazine, you're not very well educated in this area. So you need to go write a book with Raymond and learn something about near-death experiences. And so that's what I did. I went down to Georgia and met Raymond, and we wrote a book called The Light Beyond, which was a very general book about research that had been done since his first book, Life After Life. And I got curious in writing that book because there were things that I didn't think had been researched. One of them was children and near-death experiences. And so I said to Raymond, you know, there's some things missing from this. In Seattle, a guy named Melvin Morse. And he is, he's done research on a couple of children who've had near-death experiences. Why don't you go talk to him? So Raymond introduced me to Melvin, and I went to see him, and he was in the middle of doing a big study on children and near-death experiences. And so I convinced him that we should write a book. And I wrote a proposal. We sent the book out to 20 publishers, and it was rejected by 19 of them. And the one who accepted it, which was Diane Reverend, who was the editor of at HarperCollins, she called me up one day and she says, well, I'll take this book. She says, if you, and I'm sitting there reading rejection letters, and she says, if you do this right, it's going to be a huge bestseller. And I thought, you don't know what I'm reading right now. No, but we did it right, and it became a huge bestseller. And so I ended up doing 4 books with Melvin Morse. And those all came out of gaps in the books that we'd written before. You know, all those we decided to find the gaps in the books and write books about the gap. I did the same thing with Raymond as well. When we were, as our second book, we did a book called Coming Back. And it was a book about past life regressions. And it just came out of the blue. We had just finished Light Beyond, and we're just talking one day in his office in Carrollton, Georgia. And I said, have you ever had a past life regression? Because I had had one. And he said, yeah, I have. And we talked about that for a while and then just decided we would do our own study and take a look at what they are, what past life regressions are. And that's what we did. And it's like one thing after another always has a gap. There's always a gap there that needs to be filled. And that's what I've always tried to do with Raymond. So over the years, we'd written, I think, 4 books about near-death experiences. And I started to get a little bit skeptical about near-death experiences. And mainly because they're subjective experiences, meaning that if you have a near-death experience, you're the only one that can tell that story. Unless someone else had it with you, they couldn't tell that story. And it makes it a personal myth in many ways. So I said, we have touched on something called a shared death experience for years now. We've always had shared death experiences in every one of our books, but no one's done a book on shared death experiences, and no one has really looked at them in depth. So we started to collect shared death experience stories, which were far easier to find than I expected. And we would ask people at conferences, we would explain to them what a shared death experience is, which it's by the way, a shared death experience is when somebody who is well experiences the death experience of someone who is dying. And that could be shared psychically, in other ways too, psychically or actually sometimes. And we started to collect these shared death experiences and then got a book out. We wrote a book called Glimpses of Eternity. And that kicked off this whole field of study on shared death experiences, which, once again, I have to say, we're kind of the forerunners of. And we started to collect shared death experiences and categorize them and look at possible reasons that they happen, look at historical shared death experiences, which, you know, near-death experiences have been around since the beginning of man. And the same is true of shared death experiences. And that's what we've done now. We have a book coming out in September. We have a book coming out called Proof of Life After Life. 7 Reasons to Believe in the Afterlife. And that we categorize these into 7 categories. And we looked at them all very carefully. And that is going to advance this field substantially. Because you have certain things in shared death experiences that the National Institutes of Health are interested in. And that's a big step forward. If you can get the National Institutes interested in something that's considered woo-woo by many people, then you're really in very good shape.
Can you briefly summarize what those 7 proofs are?
Yeah, I'll just read you the table of contents from the upcoming book. One of them is out-of-body experiences. Another is precognitive experiences. A third one is transforming light, how the light transforms people during a near-death experience and how that's visible later on. Some people are healed by near-death experiences, which makes them a shared death experience. You can see the transformation in people. They're healed. They pick up what we call spontaneous muses, which means they literally, during a near-death experience, will. And then there's an interesting one called Light, Mist, and Music. That's one of our chapters. And what it deals with is quite a few doctors and nurses will see when someone dies, they'll see a mist come out of them, or they'll see a light that comes out of them, or parts of the room will light up, or music. They'll hear music, and it tends to be very angelic music that some people have spent years trying to recreate. In fact, there's a doctor in Syracuse, Tony Sirocco, who had a near-death experience and heard music and then devoted years to becoming a pianist. And he now does tours of Europe in concert halls in Austria and other places playing the piano. And he's good enough to do that. And that's the result of having this near-death experience. The mist is amazing. There's, for hundreds of years, it's been discussed among people who have been around the dying, and they'll see a mist. The same is true of lights, spontaneous lights. What they mean, no one knows. I mean, the generally speaking, doctors who see it, and the descriptions of it are almost universal. They tend to be it tends to be a greenish light, or a a white mist. And it tends to head for a portal that's high in a room and get sucked into that portal.
Writing multiple books on this topic, why do you think it's important to know the validity of this experience?
Yeah. I think people have a deep fear of death, you know, without a question. And to know what happens, to know that possibly, a high possibility actually, to know that that consciousness survives death is eye-opening to a lot of people. And to know that there's actually science on it, because to people, it's a good tool for discussing grief.
And how has this journey or discovery of near-death experience impacted you?
Oh, it's eased my fear of death for sure. You know, I mean, I think death is one of those things that people think about, not all the time, but think about it every day. It's one way or another, death comes up in their mind. And so it's very beneficial to see the other side of it, that there might well be survival of consciousness. One of the things we've done that I think it eases the fear of death for people and it opens their mind toward a near-death experience, is this big study we did in Seattle called the Transformation Study. And this was headed by Melvin Morse. And what we did was we took hundreds of people who had near-death experiences, had them answer questionnaires, and then spoke to them. And what we found, we had a lot of doctors involved in this, big neurologists at University of Washington and nurses and statisticians played a big role. And what we found was that there's some interesting things with near-death experience. One is that the most transformative element of a near-death experience is seeing the light. Once people see the light, they tend to be more transformed than people who don't. And the other thing is that people who have near-death experiences have approximately four times the number of verifiable psychic experiences as people who don't have a near-death experience. And by verifiable psychic experience, we mean an example would be if you're supposed to take an airplane to Arizona tomorrow from New York, and in the middle of the night you've had a dream that plane crashes. Then if you get up and you tell your boyfriend or a friend, I'm not going to fly today because I dreamed that plane crashed, and it does, that's a verifiable psychic experience. And we found that there's far more of those with people who have NDEs than don't. So there's some really fascinating aspects that no one anticipated and that can't really be explained.
That is fascinating. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, sure.
I would like to ask you about the importance of spiritual media in general. These spiritual medias are on the rise it's been on the rise for the recent years. What kind of impact do you think it's having on individuals?
I think it has a huge impact on individuals, and I think there's a reason for it. I think the reason is that it's like that old song, "Is That All There Is?" You know, I think a lot of people start to feel that way about life. Is this all there is? You know, I go to work all day in a cubicle, and my kids hate me, and, you know, I'm not having much fun. You know, and so they start to look for ways to overcome that. And one of the ways they overcome those feelings is through study of near-death experiences, through the study of spirituality. You know, which I think is really part of the goal of spirituality, is to soothe people about life and death.
What is the current project you're working on, and what can viewers expect from you in the future?
Well, we just finished a book Raymond and I did called Proof of Life After Life, and the subtitle is Seven Reasons to Believe in the Afterlife. Our next project is to turn those seven reasons to believe in life after life into seven masterclasses. And we want to, video the masterclasses and have so they're accessible to people anytime they want. And that's the next thing we're going to do.
You've made a film called Afterlife. And you've said that your goal is to make media that matters. Why does spiritual media on the afterlife matter?
Because people didn't know anything about it. I mean, that's one reason. But then what I started to realize is that I had written all these books on near-death experiences. I think at the time that I wrote, at the time that I made that movie, I'd probably written 5 books on near-death experiences. And don't get me wrong, I don't just deal with that subject matter. I mean, I deal with a lot of other subjects besides near-death experiences, but I'm very prolific. And I just decided to make it a very simple documentary. One where we would, the way I did it was there was a conference, International Association for Near-Death Studies. It was in San Diego. I took myself and a cameraman. We set up a hotel room, and there was a whole group of people there, and I told them all what I was doing. I'm making this film about people who've had near-death experiences. And I got like 20 people at least who sat down for interviews. And the interviews were really excellent. People are very well spoken about their experiences. And their experiences are very varied. What started to intrigue me is how people almost die, how they have a near-death experience. So there was one woman who was a child, and she was in Puerto Vallarta in Mexico, and she ran through a glass window. It was a sliding glass door, and she was running as a child and just ran through the window and was completely cut up, and she was bleeding to death, and she had a near death. Luckily, her parents. This is a whole other side to the story. Luckily, her parents went downstairs to try to find a doctor, and they ran into a doctor in the stairwell who was checking in, and they told him what happened. He went right up. He had his bag with him, and he stitched her up. I mean, she showed me her stitches. We have in the film, right back of her neck and on. She bled a lot. And in that course of time, she had this very profound near-death experience. Later, the doctor gave them his address and said, come and see me sometime next time you're in town. So the next time they were in town was a couple years later, and they went there for a vacation. And what they found was that the address he gave them had never been occupied. It was an empty lot. And she thought this was an angelic occurrence. They had this doctor show up in a stairwell. So that was interesting. That was an interesting story in how she had an NDE and how she became involved more and more in them. Another guy we talked to was an Iraqi, and he belonged to the Baha'i faith. And there was an Iraq-Iran war, and because he was Baha'i, he was put on the front lines. Because the Saddam didn't like the Baha'i, so he put him on the front lines. Everyone that was with him in his battalion was killed. He survived, and he had a lot of guilt about surviving. And he kept trying to figure out, why did I survive? And so he went to India, and he went to a guru. And the guru said, well, before you can ask questions about death, you have to experience it. So he gave him a sack of cobra venom, and it was a sack full of chilies, and he chewed on this sack full of chilies, and his throat closed up. And so he was suffocating. Luckily, there were two doctors who were with him at that time, and that really saved him. But in the meantime, he's suffocating. He has this near-death experience. And it helped him understand death. And it helped him understand that there's some people are lucky and some aren't. And that's why he survived the war. And since then, he's become, he owns a big electrical company in LA. And he's been very involved in death studies and near-death experiences. Some people just, they're making toast.